Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. Based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, I'm coming to you from our remote studio up to the north. It's my pleasure to be here today. We have a longtime favorite guest of ours returning today, talking about the updated version of his book, Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform. Our guest today on Media Matters will be Mark Crispin Miller. And believe me, if you haven't heard Mark speak, you're going to enjoy today's show. But first, before we go to Mark Crispin Miller, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Federal Communications Commission is holding its fifth official public hearing on media ownership in Chicago on Thursday, September 20th. The hearing will provide a unique opportunity for Chicago citizens to tell the FCC how well the local media is serving their community. The Chicago hearing is the fifth in a series of six public hearings that FCC Chairman Kevin Martin pledged to hold last fall before making any changes to media ownership regulations. Specifically being questioned are whether or not one company should be allowed to own multiple television and radio stations and the major daily newspaper in a single market. Chicago is the third largest media market in the country, and just four companies control more than half of its local media. The city also has one of the lowest levels of minority ownership among markets of its size and diversity. Yolanda Hippensteel, Outreach Director of Free Press, explains.
Chicago is a city where nearly two-thirds of the population are people of color, but despite the city's diversity, people of color own only 5% of Chicago's TV and radio stations. That's even lower than the national average, which is a paltry 7%. You know, in fact, Chicago is one of the 10 largest radio markets, and of those 10 largest, the only one with single-digit levels of minority ownership.
A broad coalition of national and local groups has joined together to organize around the FCC hearing. Carl West, publisher and editor of a Chicago hip-hop culture publication called The Truth Magazine, has been working to spread the word about the event. West says the current media landscape in Chicago has made it very difficult for artists to get exposure.
We have maybe three or four mainstream stations that are viable outlets, and, you know, it's absolutely close to nothing that the local artists get support on. The major radios just don't play it, of course, because they've backed and financed by the major record companies and studios, which are now owned by, you know, very few people in the industry. It makes it very, very difficult for local artists to get any kind of exposure via radio, which in that case makes it very difficult for an artist to move product, which is sell records. So it's a very, very depressing state of mind for a lot of the artists. I mean, they feel really shut out of the system that way.
Some Chicago citizens are using the media to address the issue of media consolidation. Mitchell Strapinchik, longtime organizer with Chicago Media Action, placed his five-minute testimony to the FCC on the video website YouTube.
How is the public harmed by increasingly concentrated media? Let me count the ways. I often list five common consequences that extrapolate widely. One, more commercialism in media. Two, less localism in media. Three, less quality journalism. Four, less independent music. And five, fewer diverse perspectives.
The hearing will take place at Rainbow Push National Headquarters on Chicago's South Side. For more information, visit stopbigmedia.com.
The 2008 presidential election is already getting so much media attention. Important state and local races often get overlooked. public access TV stations across the nation are filling the void. In Santa Barbara, California, the city council approached the local community station to give candidates without deep pockets access to airtime. Hap Freund is the executive director of the Santa Barbara Channels.
We gave each candidate 45 minutes to tape a 3-minute statement, and then the candidates would be able to have 3 takes, and then they were to pick the take they wanted, and we had them sign off on it, so that it kind of levels the playing field.
Freund says that many community stations have been doing this public service for years with candidate and issue forums, but the candidate statements have a value all their own. A video voter guide is available for community media broadcasters interested in presenting the election process in a fair way with equal access for the candidates. The Santa Barbara Channels will air the candidate statements several times a week at different times of the day just before mail-in ballots are sent out.
This particular mode of doing it, it's not the most exciting mode, but I think it's very direct, very straightforward, and it removes all implications of bias. It's like a visual rendition of what many states and cities issue, which is a printed pamphlet with each candidate having an opportunity to make a written statement.
For more information about the Video Voter Guide, go to www.videovoter.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okey-dokey. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in truly beautiful Urbana, Illinois, where we're based. It's my pleasure today to have as our guest Mark Crispin Miller, Professor of Culture and Communication at NYU, New York University, and a very well-known public intellectual. He's written several books, countless articles. He's been on radio and television. And we are privileged to have Mark Crispin Miller joining us today live from his home in New York here on Media Matters. And Mark Crispin Miller is the author of the brand new book, or the revised version, I should say, of a book that's a year or so old, Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform. Mark Crispin Miller, welcome to Media Matters.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
It's a great pleasure to have you on. And I must say, as one of the fringe benefits of my job is I get to read a lot of books by really good authors to prepare for my show every week. And we have some terrific writers who've written books that I've had a chance to read and then interview on the show, Barbara Ehrenreich, Tom Frank, Naomi Klein. But you are as gifted a writer as any wordsmith we've ever had. It's really a pleasure to read you.
Gee, thanks.
No, it really is. And I think if people read Mark's work, you'll see that, you know, this is someone, your critics probably have accused you of writing fiction. But certainly you're capable of being a wonderful fiction writer if your career in this area, finishes up sooner than you
Well,
like.
Bob, you know how much money we make doing what we do. why would I want to do anything else?
Well, let me start the interview today with Mark Miller by just telling a story. I remember on Election Day in 2004, I was talking to a friend of mine, John Nichols, who was a frequent guest on the show and a great writer in his own right. And he was following what was going on in Ohio very closely. And he said he spoke to political operatives in Ohio. This is late afternoon on Election Day 2004. And he said they were giddy with enthusiasm, that they had never seen such a strong Democratic turnout in their history of working the polls in Ohio going back decades. And I think even including the 64 election, which was the landslide of Goldwater, that just the difference between 2000 and 1996 and 1992 was palpable. And all of them, to a person, was convinced that not only would Kerry win Ohio, he would win it going away.
Right.
And, the mood in the Kerry camp, and certainly the mood among the Democrats that John Nichols was interviewing for his coverage for The Nation, was just one of, you know, happy days are here again. We've just won a major victory, not even a close one.
Right.
Then I went to teach my class, which lasts 3 hours, and I came out of the class, and, you know, I was expecting to, you know, have people who I knew who were Democrats who were just going to be breaking champagne corks out of the bottles and jumping up and down. And I called up Nichols, and I said, what's the mood now? And he said, well, I've called around all the Democratic sources, and it's sort of like things have really taken a strange turn. It suddenly doesn't look that good at all. And it was really quite striking to me because the exit polls upon which the enthusiasm, some of it had been based, had been so strongly for Kerry in a number of states, and especially in Ohio, had apparently proven incorrect.
Yeah.
And I remember the reason, this is a long preface to get the conversation I had with you, Mark Miller, a few days later, a personal conversation, so we're friends. And you said the election was, it was clearly ripped off. It was a bogus election. There was chicanery. And of course, you said it with such assurance, I was struck. Also, since you made the statement so quickly after the election, it wasn't, then you went on to write Fooled Again, and you have been working on this issue as diligently, though not alone, as we'll talk about today, with several other journalists and researchers, and uncovering this issue. And now here we are, 3 years later, nearly, and you've got the new version of Fooled Again out. And I think for a lot of our listeners, Mark Miller, there's probably a sense that, you know, they don't really know a lot about this. It's one of the things you talk about in the afterword to the new edition. It's the nature of the press coverage. And maybe before we go into some of the more recent stuff and what's happened and how the press has covered it and how the Democrats have responded to it, and your quite now famous conversation with John Kerry on this issue, just talk about some of the basics. When you say that the 2004 election was stolen, and you say the 2006 election had all sorts of chicanery, so that listeners unfamiliar with this argument, just give some of the basics of what you're talking about, would you?
Okay, well, the first point to make is that the Bush regime, or we could call it the extremist wing of the Bush Republican Party, despite its reputation for incompetence, you know, we're always hearing how incompetent they are, they're exceptionally good at one thing, and that is the subversion of democracy. And one of the ways in which they have demonstrated their skill at this infernal talent has been in stealing elections, gaming elections, rigging them with great artfulness, which has involved using not one particular trick. There is no one smoking gun, but a whole range of tactics and devices, some of which are quite old, you know, venerable sort of Jim Crow era tactics like old-fashioned intimidation, bullying, disinformation, that kind of thing, which both parties have, you know, engaged in over the decades in our history, but also all kinds of fairly novel tricks that are played through the use of electronic voting machines, through the use of computerized polling books, and this kind of thing enables theft on a scale far larger than the old-fashioned methods, and it has the added advantage of being entirely undetectable. Now, let me answer your question more pithily. We have literally thousands and thousands of reports, not just in Ohio, but from all over the country in 2004, of people pushing the button to vote for Kerry and having the vote turn before their very eyes into a Bush vote. This is called vote flipping. And it, let me repeat, only represents one of literally dozens of different kinds of tricks for the disenfranchisement of the majority. Now, if you look very, very hard, Bob, you can find, as far as I know, a total of five cases out of those thousands in which people tried to vote for Bush and had, you know, the vote flipped to Kerry. All the others were Kerry votes flipped to Bush votes. Now,
Mark, let me just interrupt you for 1 second, though. Could it be that people who voted for Kerry and it came, or excuse me, voted for Bush and it came up Kerry, didn't complain since Bush actually won the elections, and says no big deal?
Well, it could be, except for the fact that even though the Republicans are often on the losing side, in fact, you know, in objective fact, they, I argue, have been on the losing side all along. They have always been very quick to complain about any attempt to interfere with their votes, and I say more power to them. I mean, there is a certain amount of paranoia on the right, as I point out in two of the chapters, two crucial chapters of Fooled Again. Indeed, a lot of the election fraud committed by the Republicans has been motivated by a conviction that they are only acting in self-defense, that they're fighting fire with fire. And this gets us into the whole question of the kind of paranoid mindset we're dealing with.
To a preemptive strike.
Preemptive striking. And, you know, this is the same mentality that drove the Great Crusades, that drove the war, the Indian Wars in our history, that drove the Cold War. I mean, it's really it's a kind of a universal mentality. The Nazis themselves actually believed that they were fighting a defensive war against world Jewry. And, I can go on listing examples, but the fact is that the Republicans would be very quick to complain if they could come up with any examples of you know, interference with their efforts to vote. The fact is that the disproportion is so vast in this, just in this one case, that it demonstrates quite clearly that the machines had to have been fixed in order for the results to be so one-sided. Now, let me elaborate from this to make the point that all the different kinds of machine malfunction, and that would include the systematic shortages of voting machines in Democratic precincts only. We heard something about this happening in Ohio. As a matter of fact, it happened in Wisconsin. It happened in Michigan. It happened all throughout the South. It happened in Pennsylvania. It actually happened here in New York, in my own voting place. It happened all over the country, and there is no case that anyone has been able to discover of it happening in a Republican precinct. Now I'm giving you a short answer to your question. It is to say that there has been a carnival of fraud and vote suppression in the last three or four elections, national elections, and out of all proportion, they have afflicted Democrats only. Now, I am not a Democrat, Bob. I want to make that abundantly clear. Having read the afterword to the book, you probably understand why I am, you know, sort of vehement about not being a Democrat, because the Democrats are sitting by and allowing this to happen. Maybe a handful are actually, you know, colluding with it. My point here is not, oh, the poor Democrats, they're being shortchanged. My point here, obviously, is that the vote represents the will of the people. I don't for a moment believe that the right to vote represents our only, that voting represents our only possible political response to the status quo. I think we need to vote, we need to hold elections, and we need to do plenty of other things. However, I also believe that if we do not have the right to vote, as we no longer do, in effect, we are in serious danger. Whatever issue most concerns us, whatever it may be, if we don't have the right to vote, if we don't have the power to choose or evict our representatives, we have no power on any other front through any other tactic, and the government will act with impunity as it has been doing since Bush rose illegitimately to power in the first place.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Mark Crispin Miller, New York University professor, author of the book Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform, published by Basic Books, which has caused such a stir over the past 2 years. This new edition, which has just come out, has a 100-page afterword, which I had the privilege of reading this weekend, which really updates the story since 2004-2005, and is worth the price of admission in its own right, if I may say so. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Mark Crispin Miller, the number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Mark, a couple points I want you to clarify also about your argument for our listeners. First of all, is there a concerted master plan that guides this, that's driving this, that is a conscious plan where all these disparate elements of fraud are put together, where we can actually link it to Karl Rove or Dick Cheney or to George W. Bush? Does Bush know about it?
Well,
let's start there.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm certainly not privy to, you know, the inner workings of that machine. But if you study, you know, individual instances of surprising wins by this particular ticket, you can't draw any conclusion other than the one that this is certainly a masterminded operation. It takes a tremendous amount of control and coordination. For instance, I'm going to recommend several of the books, as I do in the afterword to my book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great new book, well, it's not new anymore, by David Moore, who is was a very high-placed and well-respected officer at the Gallup organization, a very respected pollster, who was there in 2000 when the exit poll people were trying to decide what to do in the wake of Fox News's sudden declaration that Bush had won Florida. We all remember this. You know, Gore was obviously winning. All of a sudden, Fox News said, "No, no, it's Bush." And Moore tells the really amazing story of how the exit poll people basically knuckled under. The book came out last fall from Nation Books, and it's quite clear from that book and other accounts that between the Bush brothers and Rupert Murdoch and Catherine Harris, there was a tremendous amount of coordination. Now, this thing was done more or less on the fly. This is the early days of Bush-Cheney's regime of fraud. If, then, you turn from that pivotal state in 2000, which was Florida, to the pivotal state of Ohio in 2004, you find a remarkable amount of very careful strategic activity by Ken Blackwell, who, like Catherine Harris, was not only Secretary of State, but co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign in his state, who copied many of the tactics and tricks that were used by Catherine Harris's machine in Florida, and who was, quite clearly in close contact with the Republican National Committee. All across the board, Bob, you find that individual cases of chicanery or malfeasance are connected to the Republicans at the very highest level. For example, in 2002, there were four upset victories by far right-wing senators in that race, including, of course, Norm Coleman's victory after the death of Paul Wellstone. This was, a very important sweep for the Republican Party because, as you'll recall, Jim Jeffords had jumped ship and the Senate had, by a hair's breadth, slipped over to Democratic control. So there were these, remarkable shifts at these four different states, the most dramatic of which was Georgia, where Max Cleland was surprisingly defeated, and this loss had everything to do with Diebold voting machines. However, in New Hampshire, it turned out there was a phone jamming ring run by local Republican operatives in the four largest cities of southern New Hampshire. The purpose of this phone jamming ring was to interfere with the attempt to get out the labor vote for the Democratic candidate in New Hampshire. And it soon emerged that all the legal expenses for the suspects in the case, who were later convicted, were paid by the Republican National Committee. And after these guys had done their time, they were all reassigned to other election work by the Republican Party elsewhere in the country. One other example, I have a great deal in the book about an operative from Arizona named Nathan Sproul, who has a rich background in the Christian Coalition and in Republican Party politics. Fooled Again has the most comprehensive account of his activities before the 2004 election, where he basically ran phony voter registration drives in at least half a dozen states from coast to coast.
What do you mean by phony, Mark?
Well, they posed as opinion pollsters, and they would approach people at malls and so on and ask them seemingly progressive-sounding questions like, what did they think of global warming or of Ralph Nader or something like that? And then they would inveigle people into filling out voter registration forms, and they would destroy the ones that were filled out by Democrats and keep the ones that were filled out by Republicans. And it also turns out in many cases that they would actually surreptitiously register Democrats as Republicans, which I think served the purpose of inflating the numbers of Republicans, this being an overall necessity over the last several years, because we're talking about a movement that has succeeded far beyond its actual numbers. That's one of the most basic points I'm trying to make here is that the far right wing, the theocratic wing, the wing that applauded how the Bush brothers handled the Terry Schiavo case, the wing that was actually pleased about the drowning of New Orleans, that wing is quite small. And the wing that supports this government's other policies is quite small. Once we grasp that they have won their victories primarily through fraud, I think, we can emancipate ourselves from the crippling illusion that the country is somehow evenly divided and that the Republican Party has a considerable base of support. And anyway, I've kind of strayed away from answering your other question.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark Miller, before you stray back to answering that question, let me let our listeners here at WILL AM 580 know you're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our guest today, Mark Crispin Miller, the author of Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform. Mark Miller's been on the show before. He's been all over the media, although probably not as much about this book as he'd like. We'll talk about that. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Mark Crispin Miller, the number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Mark, we have several callers who have been patiently waiting. Let's get to them, and then we can keep getting back to the issues at hand.
Okay.
Line 4, Farina, waiting patiently. Thank you very much. You're on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Hi. Well, what a honor and a pleasure to speak with people that actually know something about something. And Mr. Miller, your conclusions just seem to have the ring of truth. It just thing after thing after thing. Bush would like to compare himself to the greats of history. I read a little bit of the Halberstam article in Vanity Fair, the History Boys. Winston Churchill apparently was quoted as saying, Americans will always do the right thing after they've tried everything else. Which I think is just applicable to this administration. It just seems that they're just capable of the most nefarious actions imaginable, and with money and power as their gods. I mean, literally, that they worship at that. And just thank you for your work and your voice. Just thank you.
Well, thank you. Was there a question there? Or?
No, I think it was just a fan of yours, Mark Miller.
But he's the one, huh?
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, no, I mean, I can't emphasize this strongly enough. You know, if you read most punditry out there, even quite liberal punditry, you still discover an unconscious eagerness to believe that this administration and their party are more or less within the mainstream of American political tradition, and they are not. They're not within that mainstream. They are not rational players, and they have no intention of playing by the rules. Moreover, they absolutely loathe the Constitution, and they detest democracy. We've certainly seen that in their treatment of, you know, places like Haiti. But it's especially true here, and, you know, we have to understand this because I don't really believe for a moment that they intend to let themselves be ushered out of power legitimately, because they have, you know, for one thing, they're in a lot of trouble legally, but they also don't believe that it's right, you know, either in civic terms or in God's eyes, that they step down. So I think we have to be prepared to fight much harder than we've been fighting.
Well, Mark Miller, I mean, what some people have said to me when they've heard your thesis, and not just your work, as you talk about, you go at some length praising and commenting on the government reports, the Conyers report, the General Government Accountability Office report on election problems, the other research being done by a number of people. You've mentioned some already. But what people say is, okay, so maybe there was some chicanery, but, you know, the margin in Ohio in 2004 was, you know, over 100,000 votes. You can't chicaner that much. And then they say in 2006, if there's all this chicanery going on that no one's paying attention to, how come the Democrats win a landslide?
Okay, two questions. First of all, it's extremely easy to alter a vote count by whatever, 130,000, 118,000, I believe it was. That's a piece of cake. Moreover, this didn't happen only in Ohio. You know, people take refuge in this notion But it was pretty even all over the country. It came down to Ohio, where the margin was razor thin and Bush squeaked by. There is, I believe, sufficient evidence to estimate that Kerry won or would have won this election by between 7 and 10 million votes. You know, the turnout numbers that we have received are completely unreliable for the simple fact that all over the country, tens of thousands of people could not vote. You know, they showed up to vote, for example, and they were told, you're not registered. This happened, you know, to between 10 and 20% of the Democratic voters in several crucial Ohio counties. We know about this. I mean, I made this revelation in Fooled Again. Bob Fitrakis, who's a great activist in Ohio, who knows more about Ohio politics and voting than anyone alive, on the basis of that revelation, went ahead and discovered that it was indeed the case. So the turnout, you know, everything that we think we know about ourselves as political actors has got to be revised. You know, there are more of us than them, and by us I don't mean liberals, I don't mean Democrats, I mean rational people. By far there are more of us than them. Bush's regime is grossly unpopular. The turnout has been much higher than we think. And I really get tired of hearing people say, well, you know, Americans are so stupid and apathetic, they don't care. That seems to me to be an argument that's, you know, better suited to fascism than any other form of government, because at least fascism is efficient. And if Americans are too dumb and too easily and permanently distracted to govern themselves, then, you know, you and I should find another line of work because we're wasting our time. But the fact is, you know, the numbers that we've received are, they've got to be understood in context. So, you know, it's very, very easy to alter election results secretly and quickly. All you have to do is the most cursory study of what it takes to alter memory cards and voting machines, on which well over 80% of Americans now cast their votes, to see that the kind of alteration that took place in Ohio was a piece of cake.
Well, then, Mark, let me just interrupt. How come in 2006, then, they didn't monkey enough with the memory cards so that the Republicans would hold the House and Senate?
That's a very good question. And the answer is as follows. This is based on a major study that was carried out by the Election Defense Alliance, specifically Jonathan Simon and Bruce O'Dell, wrote an essay that's online, and it will be included in a book of essays I'm editing for IG Publishing. It will be out in January, called Loser Take All. But for now, if people want to read that essay, its title is Landslide Denied. And this is not a speculation. This is based on careful study of the exit polls. The version that came out the night of Election Day, that is to say the unadjusted exit polls, and then the so-called adjusted exit polls that came out the next morning. Now, let me answer the question on the basis of that essay as succinctly as I can. It is quite clear that the Republicans gave themselves a four-point advantage through electronic means ahead of time in most states in the country. You can do this very easily by pre-programming the machines. A 4% advantage. Now, they couldn't go any higher than that, because that would have been outside the margin, beyond the margin of error. And as I said before, the Republicans are very competent at this, and they don't pull off any eye-popping surprises. You know, red states never go blue and vice versa. So they did this, and they had to do it, understand, fairly early on, long before Election Day, because by now people had been watching the system fairly vigilantly, because people were more and more learning to distrust these machines, and rightly so. Well, this is where it gets interesting, and this has to do with the extremism and the recklessness of this regime. I believe we're now living through a moment similar to the 50s, when the establishment kind of turned against Joe McCarthy, or similar to the late 60s and early 70s, when there was a rift within the establishment over the Vietnam War. I think we're living through a similar moment now. I think that the establishment basically does not support this regime. It is economically too reckless. It has destroyed the American military. It's basically bad for business, certainly bad for Americans standing abroad. And that's not good for, you know, that's not good for business as usual. This explains why, within 2 weeks leading up to Election Day, there suddenly came out of this establishment some stories that really hurt the Republicans. One was the Mark Foley scandal, which was the first Republican sex scandal ever to be covered by the major media in this country. The other was Bob Woodward's third book, the third volume in his trilogy, Bush at War. All of a sudden, this third volume, after two volumes of, you know, intensive ass-kissing, basically, all of a sudden this volume is extremely critical and creates headlines that are very bad for the campaign. The Foley scandal and the Woodward book, and to some extent the outing of Ted Haggard, which happened just a few days before Election Day, all these things, I think, happened too late to save the Republicans' bacon in many of the states where they plan to squeak by. This explains why they didn't win as many seats as they intended to win. Now, my view is that the Republicans actually lost many more seats than they think, than we think they did. In my afterword, I tell the story, for example, of three Florida Democrats who lost and who then proceeded. These guys are Clint Curtis, John Russell, and Frank Morales. They all ran good, hard races against vulnerable Republican opponents. They all lost. They then proceeded to collect signed, sworn affidavits from individual voters in their respective districts, and they thereby gathered, not evidence, Bob, but proof, documentary proof, that the official vote counts in all three races were off by between 12 and 24 points. Now, you know, a lot of Democrats who lost were urged by the Democratic Party to just let it go, because that's the attitude of the Democratic Party toward all this. These three guys would not let it go. They brought their evidence to the House Administration Committee. They brought it to Congress. This is a committee now in Democratic hands, because this happened only a few months ago. And the House Administration Committee voted unanimously not to look at the evidence at all. See? So, you know, we can talk, if you like, about the motives for the Democrats in their turning such a blind eye to all this. But what I'm suggesting to you is that the 2006 election, despite the fact that it was a seeming setback for the Republicans, really ought to have been a complete rout, you see. And if you examine the victories by many of the Bush congresspersons, you know, very narrow victories in many cases, they were more often than not extremely suspicious races marked by all kinds of irregularities. Those candidates managed to squeak by, but I believe that, I believe that the unpopularity of the Bush regime, which was already, should have been decisive before the 2004 election, was pretty much total by 2006.
Mark Miller, I want to interrupt right now because we have several callers who've been just waiting very patiently.
Have I answered your question?
I think, and then some.
Okay.
I think you've done a terrific job. Our guest, Mark Crispin Miller. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We've got a couple of very patient callers I want to get to now. Line one, Eureka, you're on the air.
Yes. Yesterday on C-SPAN, Dick Morris, the former Clinton advisor, was on, and he was speaking before the Republican Women's and I did not realize that he switched to Fox News. I'm not sure. I don't think you give me your opinion now of his ability to speak to current political issues.
Mark?
I couldn't hear a word of that.
You know, I couldn't either.
I'm sorry. Yesterday, Dick Morris was on C-SPAN.
Okay. What'd he say?
And he was making a lot of remarks before a Republican group.
Right.
And I'm wondering, do you think he has any credibility left having switched? I guess he's on the Fox News network now.
Oh,
and in what he says about presidential issues or current day issues?
I've always been a little distrustful of Dick Morris because he's, you know, clearly a self-seeking character. Why do you ask?
He just seems to be very opportunistic. He would cross sort of half right, half left, but I wasn't quite sure, and I didn't realize that he had switched to the Fox News network. But that sort of made me suspicious of him right there.
Well, yeah, I don't I wouldn't turn to him as any kind of an oracle.
I just thought he may have some insight, that's all.
Oh, he might. I don't think he's going to share it with me.
No.
But, you know, since you've brought this up, I do want to say that I don't have any faith in most democratic strategists when it comes to the issue of genuine democracy. I don't think the Democratic Party is interested at all, any more than the media, by and large, is interested in it. If they were interested in it, they would have taken on this issue long since. I mean, you know, the question of the disenfranchisement of felons, for example, which is still a problem in a number of states. You know, in the interests of universal suffrage, the Democrats ought to have been on this issue, but they don't care. They don't care that in the black community, people, first of all, tried very, very hard to vote all over the country in 2004. And those people who tried to vote also believe that the race was stolen. Not only did the Democrats show a marked indifference to this whole problem, but Donna Brazile has spoken with contempt and incredulity that so many African-American voters seem to think that the race was stolen. I have a quote in Fooled Again in which she just can't figure out, you know, what's eating these people, why they're so deluded, and is wondering what they can do to educate them, to show them that there's really nothing that wrong with the system.
You know, Mark, if I can interrupt this point, because I think this is an issue you talk about at great length in the afterword to Fooled Again, which is one, the Democratic Party's response to the evidence that's been marshaled about chicanery in the elections and fraud and theft on one hand, and also the way the news media, not just mainstream news media, but also the liberal, pro-democratic, progressive news media have responded to this evidence.
Yeah.
And talk, if you would, you've been talking about the Democrats, but talk, if you would, about how the New York Times and the mainstream news media have responded to it on one hand, and then also how the Nation, progressive in these times, just the works on the liberal and progressive news media.
Okay. Well, the progressive has seen the light on this issue, and in these times hasn't been too bad on it. You know, Joel Blyfus has co-authored a great book with Steve Freeman on the theft of the 2004 election.
And Joel Blyfus, the editor of
In These Times. The editor of In These Times. But the, on the one hand, the corporate press, the mainstream press, has simply ignored this whole issue. And they ignored it willfully and nearly totally. I have heard people say that there was a lockdown in the media on the whole question of fraud in the 2004 election. I don't know if I believe that it's that cut and dried. I'm prepared to believe it. But I do know that there is a definite allergy at places like the Times and the networks and so on to the whole question of fraud. Now, what that has meant is that these media have ignored the issue. It's just not an issue as far as they're concerned. But what, you know, the real damage, I believe, that's been done by the press has been done by the left. You know, and I say this with some indignation and considerable astonishment, and it's something I go into in great detail in the afterword to the book. Mother Jones, Salon, The Nation, repeatedly, and on the part of many writers at The Nation, and TomPaine.com, all in various ways made the case, or tried to make the case, when my book and other books on the subject came out, that there was simply no evidence of fraud. No evidence. These reviews I refer to all echoed one another. They all failed to deal responsibly or at all thoroughly with the books in question. You know, mine is only one of many. And what I do in the afterword is go through their arguments point by point to demonstrate that if there's no evidence for anything, it's the claim that there's no evidence of fraud. In other words, this notion is itself baseless. There is nothing but evidence of fraud. There is, in fact, almost no evidence that Bush and Cheney won their elections legitimately. You know, whether you're talking about exit polls, whether you're talking about the action on Wall Street and in Vegas, both of which put Kerry way ahead on Election Day, you know, however you slice it, whatever whether it's anecdotal evidence or inferential evidence or statistical evidence, there is a wealth of evidence that the election has been stolen and that they are making plans right this minute to steal the next election and give us a President Giuliani. Now, the left press did worse damage than the mainstream press precisely because the left press did not ignore the issue. The left press went out of its way to create the very comforting myth that there's no evidence of fraud. And when this kind of claim comes from the left, obviously, you know, the mainstream press will then invoke that and say, well, these people don't even think the election was stolen. Obviously, this is a crackpot position. And this is precisely what happened. When Bobby Kennedy Jr. came out with his terrific piece on fraud in Ohio.
And for listeners who might not be familiar, this is a piece that Robert Kennedy Jr., a cover article for Rolling Stone magazine in 2006, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the summer of 2006. Farhad Manjoo of Salon attacked the article with a kind of hysteria. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. I mean, it was just a venomous, irresponsible, and uninformed attack, despite the weakness of his attack, and despite the fact that Salon received over 400 emails. Many of the people who wrote those emails were experts on election procedures and so on, and who had studied the situation. Over 400 emails of complaint came into Salon. They eventually had to take Manjoo off the election beat, despite the fact that his work was completely disgraced and repudiated. Fox, CNN, all of them either actually had Bobby Kennedy sit with Manjoo in a kind of point-counterpoint, or else would bring up points that Manjoo had made as if to say, well, if Salon, a liberal magazine, feels this way, Bobby Kennedy, you're obviously, you know, off the deep end in this case, as you always have been, you know, with your environmental stuff and so on. So you know, this, you know, I believe that I could explain, yeah, at least my view of why all of these guys, you know, these liberal writers would take this position. I don't think we have time for the explanation. It's in the afterword to Fooled Again. But I think we are in a very dangerous place when even progressive organs take such a cavalier view of one of our most fundamental civic rights and responsibilities.
Mark Kristen Miller, let me reintroduce you to our listeners. You're the author of the brand new book, Fooled Again. Well, the revised version of the brand new book, I should say, the brand new afterword,
right,
and 100 pages of new material. And the subtitle, The Real Case for Electoral Reform, published by Basic Books. He's joining us today here live on Media Matters, WILL AM 580. We've been talking about election fraud, election theft, the rampant spread of it over the past decade. According to Mark Miller, we've had a lot of callers. We have two people waiting very patiently to speak with Mark Miller. I want to get back to the phone lines right now. Line 3, a long-distance call from Wayne, New Jersey, Hutch.
Hi, Bob. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Hutch.
It's wonderful to hear you. And, Bob, it's just a thrill to hear you. I just wish this thing were syndicated national and you were replacing Larry King so we could have something worth listening to on television.
I haven't been married enough times.
Well, listen, I it's a magnificent show, and I simply want to put in my two cents and say to everybody who's listening that, and, you know, I drive Mark crazy because he knows what I'm about to say, but in fact, I'm telling the truth, and that is, this is, Fooled Again is one of the most important books published today. Probably, frankly, I think it's just about the most important book in print today, and everybody needs to go out and buy it. You've got to understand the nature of the crisis. And we, over here in New Jersey, we work in the impeach movement, and we have a website called impeachthem.com. And I think, Mark, there are two places where people have got to understand this. It's very crucial to understand two primary points. And the first is this notion that Mark talked about earlier with you, Bob, which is the problem of perception. That is to say, people who consider themselves progressive, enlightened, liberal, they seem to feel as though they're in this small, tiny group. And the plain facts show it is exactly the opposite. In other words, if you're for impeaching Bush, for example, you're in the majority, but you're not just in the majority. You're in the majority by a landslide. You go to our website, impeachthem.com, you see a link to a poll on MSNBC. Now, listen to this, Bob. This poll has been up for a while. It just passed 560,000 total votes. And out of 560,000 votes, answering the question, do you think President Bush's actions justify impeachment, 501,000, over a half million people, out of only, gee whiz, 560,000 total, 89% say Bush should be impeached. That's significant. That is real significant. And, you know, you got to ask yourself the question, why, gosh, why doesn't Keith Olbermann tout this on his program on MSNBC? I don't know what the answer to that is. But the point is, you got to understand that if you are for justice, for democracy, you are definitely in the majority. That's got to be understood. And the second point is that we say in the impeach movement that we aim to restore justice by impeaching the Bush gang and by reclaiming democracy. And that's the other crucial thing. You have to understand, we don't live in a democracy right now. That's the point of Mark's book. We're not in a democracy. Democracy was stolen from us. So therefore, we say, if you, we understand that impeaching Bush, you can get rid of those bad guys, but if they control the voting process, it doesn't mean anything. So we've got to insist on a voter's bill of rights. We've got to get rid of the electronic voting machines that can be rigged. We've got to have hand-counted paper ballots. Why? Because with hard copy paper, the guy's counting, you can watch him, you can say, wait a minute, you missed one there, let's count that again. You can't do that with electronic data.
Hutch, I want to thank you for that, you know, bill of goods in particular for reform. And if you don't mind, I'm going to take that as a chance to turn to Mark, because I know we're winding down here in the show, and I've got another caller I want to do, Mark. Maybe you could add to what Hutch just said. I mean, for people who share Hutch's concerns and your concerns about this issue, what are steps citizens can take to correct this problem?
Well, on the local level, which is all important, people should definitely get involved in election reform activities. You know, there are great groups and fairly large groups in state after state after state, and I think we have to be prepared in 2008 to monitor the whole process extremely carefully, because whatever reforms the Democrats will come up with by then, let me not be too pessimistic. It is likely that whatever reforms the Democrats come up with by then will be insufficient to protect us from fraud. I think we do need a system based on hand-counted paper ballots, and I think that is ultimately what we will have. But speaking a bit more generally, and to bring this question home to you, Bob, to some extent, because I'm reading your great new book, Communication Revolution, there are three issues that are crucial, and to concentrate on any single one of them to the exclusion of the other two, I think is a mistake. Those three issues are election reform, okay, which means making the whole process of voting and vote counting entirely open to the public. We need popular control and oversight of the voting system. If the parties, either one of them or both of them, is involved in that process, the process will be corrupt. But along with election reform, we need, obviously, campaign finance reform, because if we can't get clean money behind our politics simply belong to the highest bidder. And thirdly, and probably most important, is media reform. Here, as ever, I defer to you, but those three issues are all joined at the hips, if I can sort of come up with a grotesque metaphor. Those three things have to happen. My experience, not only with studying these elections, but with trying even to talk publicly about them, has made this fact abundantly clear to me. So, you know, people should choose one of those three things, but whatever they do, they have to be prepared to face this next election, not with fear and not in a mood of depression, but with kind of fervent indignation and a very, very pronounced willingness and eagerness to defend their rights as citizens.
Mark, Chris and Miller, we have two callers who have been waiting very patiently. We've only got a few minutes left. So let's try to run them in, them on the air.
Quick.
Line 2, Rantoul, thank you so much for your patience. You're on the air with Mark, Chris, and Miller.
Hi, Hi. Thank you for this topic. It's fascinating. I wanted to ask your guest, well, let me back up. I've been an election judge for many years, down south and now here in Illinois, and I'm just having a hard time picturing the vast amount of people that would have to be in on an activity like this across the nation, knowing the minutiae of the job that I do on election day.
Right.
Could your caller speak to that?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's a very good question. All I can do is urge you to read up on what happened in 2004. This isn't simply a pitch for my book, although I'm happy to make one.
Well, there are several other books.
I talk about them all in the afterword. It doesn't really take that many people to pull this off, Rantoul.
It doesn't require that everyone be in on it.
It doesn't require that everyone be in on it. Now, you may not know, since the press has not reported it, that there have been convictions in Ohio, for example. In Cuyahoga County, a crucial county, there were convictions last year of a couple of people who actively interfered with the recount at the behest of Ken Blackwell. We don't know this kind of thing precisely because the press doesn't report it, but it's, you know, in the age of high technology, when the system is privatized and computerized, you'd be surprised at how few hands it really takes to make changes that can result in the erasure of several million votes. We should go on to your other call.
Yeah, let's go out to our final caller for the day, line 4, Bement. You're on the air with Mark Kristen Miller.
Yeah, hi. A long time and famous talk show host Mike Malloy says that demonstrations don't work anymore. You know, see the massive anti-war demonstrations, and that he's not going to go to another protest unless they ask him to bring a loaded gun. In case of a martial law situation or obvious massive vote fraud situation, how far do you think we should go in having an insurrection?
Well, I think when push comes to shove, it will necessarily take, at the very least, a manifestation of collective will. Okay, may I put that as vaguely as I can? The people have to make themselves heard. A government, any government, has to fear its people. If the government doesn't have a healthy respect for its people, a respect bordering on a kind of fear, then that government will act tyrannically. I mean, this seems to me something that's self-evident, and all of history proves it. Now, a loaded gun per se, one loaded gun, you know, they have all the firepower. They believe in the Second Amendment for themselves, you know, but not for all the rest of us. But at the very least, we should be talking about a general strike, for example. At the very least, we should be talking about civil disobedience of an extremely effective kind. But demonstrations per se, I agree, they may make you feel good. But if the press, particularly if the press doesn't cover them, it's a tree falling in a forest when there's nobody there.
Mark Kristen Miller, I must say, unfortunately, the band's tuning up in the background.
Oh, dear me.
That means they're going to toss me out of the studio for Tavis Smiley. I want to thank you, Mark Miller, so much for joining us today in Media Matters.
Well, let me thank you for having me, Bob.
Always a pleasure. Mark Kristen Miller, author of the book Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform, just come out with a new afterword and 100 pages of new material. Thank you so much, Mark, and I want to thank my producer Andrew Boyle, technical director Matt Kessler. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll see you in 167 hours.